In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Anne has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
And it's a Friday night in May, which means it's always a good time in Indianapolis, Indiana. Good evening to you from inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. My name is jQuery. Mike Thompson, the other voice that you will hear shortly, Landon Coons, is the producer who is behind the scenes putting everything together for this, another episode of Beyond the Bricks. And I'm excited about this one, Mike, because as we've talked about, and we've done this before, where we've kind of tipped the cap to different forms and variations of radio, and why wouldn't we do that? Because after all, a large part of this show is involved in playing clips from radio as it relates to the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway from a nostalgic standpoint. And so therefore, we're going to do kind of that with a best of, and this is kind of basically, Mike, like I called you on the telephone on a Friday night, and we decided that we're just going to have like some sort of all-night party, right? You're going to come over, spend the night when we were 10 years old, and bring over your favorite board games and a radio, and we're going to have fun with it tonight.
Absolutely. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. And we have to shout out a couple people. Mike Sarawick, who did the all-night race party on 1070 back in the day when 1070 was on the air. And also Keith Johnson, who runs DrIndy.com. I mentioned him before. He's an audio historian, does a lot of things like myself, trying to collect audio and preserve audio and really, he's a historian of the sport, and he's very, very interesting guy. But what I want to shout him out for is he's preserved a number of these all-night race parties that would be lost to history otherwise. And the more he's been posting them on his site on drindy.com, the more I've been listening to him, the more I'm like, well, there's a little nugget. We should play that. So I finally had enough of the number of these that he's put up. We finally had enough to do a whole show on him. So definitely some cool stuff tonight. I think you're going to find some really interesting things that you may not have known tonight.
So if we are playing radio clips from the all-night race parties, the best of, if you will, from over the years, and those, of course, as you mentioned, Mike Sarawick would put together for 1070 WIBC. And for those of you not familiar with either the business of radio in Indianapolis or just Indianapolis radio in general, there's a backstory as to why now, obviously, it's 93.5, 107.5, The Fan, and 93.1 WIBC. We can get to that in a moment, but I ask you to all do for me this. Suspend yourself into the past. Suspend the current reality. And yes, I realize what you're about to hear, you might have heard as recently as 20 years ago in its live formatting. But for me personally, when I hear the jingle we're about to hear, I'm instantly a child in my grandparents' home in Claremont at the age of 5 or 6 on one of their radio intercom systems that a lot of ranch-style homes had back then that would go from one room to the next listening to the radio, and it instantly takes me there. Mike, for you, when you hear it, you think and remember and nostalgically long for what?
The first time I ever came to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, we were on the way down 16th Street sitting in a traffic jam, and I was sort of dozed off because I wasn't used to being up all night. And all of a sudden, this voice from God came on, and I heard this for the first time, and I was hooked immediately.
The voice of God actually is by the name of Chuck Riley, and this is the oh-so-awesome and familiar alert.
The exclusive radio home of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. the exclusive radio home of the world's biggest and most famous race, the Indianapolis 500-1070 WIVC. Radio Indiana, WIVC, Indianapolis, and MS Communications Station.
Now, the reason that you don't hear that anymore, and it was oh so familiar, Chuck Riley's voice of the Radio Indiana, is because of the fact that the towers that transmitted the AM signal of 1070's frequency at 50,000 watts, which is why it became a juggernaut, as we call it, a blowtorch station, those antennas, those towers, were on the north side of Indianapolis, just north, as a matter of fact, along I-65 of Zionsville, Indiana. And as time went on and things began to move away from AM radio as it was, and in the early 2000s, I'm talking 2007, 2008, the decision was made to transfer, if you will, the programming of WIBC News Talk Radio in Indianapolis to 93.1 FM. And in addition to that, they decided to put 1070 AM as an all-sports radio station known as The Fan. Ultimately, The Fan would move itself to FM, 93.5, 107.5, which is, of course, now still the primary flagship for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. And because AM radio was essentially being phased out, or in this case, simply simulcasting an already now existing FM radio station, that land that the towers were on became so valuable from a commercial real estate standpoint that the decision was made to sell the towers, and thus the frequency of 1070 would go fading into the night. And at midnight of the last time that 1070 was broadcast in Indianapolis, the final thing to go out over the airwaves was that oh-so-familiar jingle. Now, the best part about the all-night race party format and everything that took into place for that is it allowed for longer interviews and just being able to talk to different personalities, different people, about everything that went into the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500-mile race. The first clip that we are going to hear is Paul Page being interviewed and talking about, and of course we have talked about the fact that Paul Page would become the chief announcer of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network, being handpicked by Sid Collins, and then taking over that role after Sid's passing in early May of 1977. Paul Page on Working with Sid Collins.
Actually, in 73, because we'd had that three-day race. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just a terrible year. I had ended up for the station working in news, doing a lot of reports from the Speedway. And that kind of perked Sid up a little bit. And he started paying attention to what I was doing, and he'd call me aside and give me this pointer, that pointer. I remember one year I interviewed the winner of the Soapbox Derby. And I came back, and it had been on the air already, and Sid was sitting and waiting for me. And, you know, that was horrible. Thank you, Sid. But when he'd do that, he'd also take the time with you.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he'd be taking an awful lot of time with you, in fact. And so in 73, after 73, they expanded the pits and made them larger, so they needed three pit reporters instead of four, and I ended up as the North Pits, which they all called the garbage pits because it was the guys who probably weren't going to do well. But what nobody figured out was in those days, anybody that ended up stopping on the circuit ended up walking down through the North Pits. So I was nagging these guys and getting interviews. And Bob talks about the tradition of people around you, which exists even there. So 74, 75, 76, I'm down there. And Maury Rose would always come down to the North Pits for the ceremonies. And he and a couple of buddies, and they had lawn chairs. And they'd set them out on the pit road. Kidding. And I'm like, what are you doing? You know, the first year, I'm like, you can't sit out there. We're going to race here. You know, 2 hours to go. I hadn't figured it out. And that's also the time when we had the little tiny walls. You know, they were 21-inch walls. And
I wanted to do the network, but I didn't really want to be in those pits a whole lot because I had guys sliding past me sideways. And, then in
Fear for Your Life.
Yeah.
You just Fear for Your Life.
Yeah. They then Sid wanted me to be his understudy. He started showing me everything.
Really?
And
so you were his intern, like during the race? During the race?
Well, no, not during the race. During the month.
Okay.
I was really his gopher. That would probably be a better. But he was spending the time, and I was learning. I mean, I was a sponge. In 76, we did every year these half-hour shows at the end of the qualifying day, 5:30 to 6 Indianapolis time. And Sid was ill one day. And Jack Morrow came to me and said, Sid's not feeling well. You need to prepare the show. And I'm like, what? And so I go to work. I went up in the tower, and I started getting everything ready. And I scared to death. And about 5:27, Sid walks through the door and says, I'll take it. I was like, oh, thank goodness. Wow. So that was kind of the lead up. And he had spent an incredible amount of time because I think he wanted it to go on. He had done so much work to make it so perfect, and he wanted a legacy to continue there. And so I at least that's, you know, he may have, it was the only guy left, but at least I'd like to believe that. Mm-hmm.
Now, Mike, what we have here is a pretty astonishing clip, as you say, of Paul Page talking about something for the 1977 broadcast that was a plan, but not necessarily an execution. Set it up for me.
That's correct. I had never heard this story until I listened to this edition of the All Night Race Party. This is an unbelievable clip. It's basically the succession plan that Paul Page and Sid Collins, that it was supposed to happen apparently in 1977, that never happened, obviously, because of Sid's untimely passing at the beginning of the month. This is really an astounding clip. It didn't end up happening, obviously, but this is what apparently was in the works, in the plans for 1977.
So how were you notified that you were going to be the next guy? I, as a matter of fact, I still remember vaguely the announcement when you were on the air with Chuck Riley doing traffic weather in a 1070 Whirly Bird. Mm-hmm. And that day that they announced that you were going to be the new voice of the 500, it's like, wow. You know,
actually, the announcement was that I was going to be the new chief announcer because everyone was very careful about that title. Mm-hmm. And It was a terrible time for us because Sid was now terminally ill. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't known that. And his doctor very wisely had prevented him from knowing that because Sid had no family to reinforce him. He wasn't married. And he died just 2 days before that decision was made. And so that month kind of, it's just a fog for me because he had become by that time a father figure. He had very few people that he was close to, maybe 6 or 7 people. And to have to take over in that way, he had originally told me in January in private that it was his intent to turn the reins over that year. It was an anniversary year for him. And he would do it mid-race. He would call the start. I would call the finish. And, of course, it never worked out that way. And
I do know this, Mike, and fascinating stuff, without question. And one of the things that was planned for, maybe not well in advance, but once the 77 race and Paul Page knew that he was doing it, one of the things that he implemented that I think you could hear for many races going forward was kind of advancing, if you will, the radio broadcast. And Mike, the easiest way to say it is to kind of take it from an old-time radio broadcast into more of a radio television broadcast, so to speak, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think Paul really in this next clip articulates that about how he brought the broadcast into more of a television phase where he was able to have the announcers, the turn announcers, be able to talk to him at a second's notice and be able to go to them, you know, go to Ron Carroll or go to whoever it was immediately, as opposed to the way Sid was doing it, where he was more master of ceremonies host, and there was a lot longer delay before, you know, Sid could toss to somebody in the turns. It's a really interesting clip, though, about how, you know, Sid did his race compared to Paul and how Paul made the changes when he took over.
It's a relationship, a symbiosis that occurs there where you know what the other guy's thinking. Now, on television, you don't get that. But in radio, especially there, you get it. And you've got these, you know, 13, in my case, other people who were so dialed into racing that you really couldn't put a foot wrong. They had all these, and they had instant access to the air. Now, I changed it from Sid. Sid used to have Jack Morrow, who was his producer and kind of his Harry Bonzel introduction announcer. And the announcers would call in, and they'd talk to either the engineering booth or to Jack Morrow, and then Jack would write on a 3x5 card and hand it to Sid, and Sid would then say, all right, we have something going on in turn one, and go out to
pretty slow
Mike Ahern or whatever. And because I'd had a little television, I wanted to get the announcers talking in my ear, and I had a button that I could talk back to them. So it went instantaneous from there, and then Bob inherited and enhanced that system. So we made a lot of changes in it, but I think working on those changes for me was a lot of fun, and having the support of that incredible group of individuals, though, and it was always incredible. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I remember probably the most memorable off-air thing was my third year, and we were just getting ready to go on the air. And the countdown was progressing, and that was a tape that one of the engineers, Tom Alibrandi, did. And we're just getting ready to go on, and Ron Carroll punches on and says, you know, I'd said, good luck, guys, and checked all the positions, and Ron punches back and says, you're the best. Go get him.
Bob Jenkins is another anchor who, of course, would do it both from the television standpoint and the radio standpoint. And you heard Paul Page talking about advancing, if you will, almost the speed of the radio broadcast. Now, at the time that Mike King was the chief radio announcer of the IMS radio network, Bob Jenkins talked with Mike Sarawick on the All Night Race Party about the duties of being both the television anchor and the radio anchor, and which one, perhaps to some, certainly Mike, surprisingly, he found to be more difficult.
I agree with the radio thing. I think I much prefer doing radio to television, except the Indy 500. And I keep hearing Mike King talk about how that's such a great job and such an easy job. Being the anchor announcer for the Indy 500 radio network was the most difficult job I ever had. And I'm not ashamed to admit that I was absolutely wore out at the end of the 500-mile race. Now, maybe I took it too seriously. I don't know. But I found that to be a very, very difficult job that I have no desire to do again.
I didn't say it wasn't fatiguing.
1070 WIBC.
There were actors that would partake in the all-night race party. Some of them, those that would drive the pace car, but were as famous as anybody on the small screen throughout the 60s and 70s. We'll let you hear from that when we roll along on this Friday night party, all-night race party version of Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial-grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there, but you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
It's a good year for Goodyear, and the good year for your car. There's a great new Goodyear tire that takes you twice as far.
Wide tread polyglass tire has a polyester cord body plus a fiberglass cord belt to give you up to double the mileage of our best selling tires.
It's a good year for Goodyear, and a good year for your car. How's the polyglass tire from Goodyear?
Polyglass tire. Only Goodyear has it.
You know who else had a fine polyester body, actually? Probably most of the singers from Up With People, which did that Goodyear commercial back in the day for the Indianapolis 500, Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Jake Query along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons. We are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center on this Beyond the Bricks, paying tribute to the all-night race parties and the interviews that would take place. When you heard that catchy music, Mike, of Up With People. And I saw your toe tapping over there, right, when it comes to the Up With People. I know what it means to you.
The best part about that, Jake, is that was a sarcastic thing I said on the script for you, that was apparently Up With People. I have no idea if that was Up With People or not, but I think that it could be. I was going to come out of that clip and say I didn't know that Up With People was doing commercials at that time, but I think that was actually pretty fun.
It's exactly who it sounds like, does it not? I mean, they were doing Super Bowl halftime shows back then. We're just going to say from now on it's Up With People, right?
I'm 100% convinced it's Up With People.
I don't think everybody's down with that, right? Look, when it comes to like famous music of the era and jingles, very few were as catchy as the opening to Rockford Files and James Garner. And James Garner, Mike, the reality is, was a huge fan and friend of the Indianapolis 500.
Absolutely. And the first 45 record I ever got was the theme from Rockford Files. My dad bought it for me. I think I was like 5 years old. So that was pretty cool. But you're right. I mean, James Garner was a great friend of the Speedway, great friend of racing. I actually got to meet James Garner at the Speedway, and I walked up to him and I did a line from the movie Grand Prix that he actually remembered the line and got a chuckle that I did the line for him. And he was very gracious and friendly. And so it was really cool to see Pete Aaron at the Speedway and in person.
Do you remember what was running through your veins at the time you were leading the pack?
Gosh, no, I don't remember. It was, you know, the first time I drove the pace car was quite a thrill. Yeah, well, so it was second and third, but, you know, when you've got 300,000 people screaming and carrying on and 33 cars with a lot of horsepower behind you, you know, it'll make you think.
Yeah.
But I just remember, and I'll always have been, it's, you know, it's the greatest spectacle in racing. And, you know, I've tried to go to as many as I could because I really enjoy it. You know, but I don't know these young guys anymore.
Yeah, they are, they're a whole new crew. As a matter of fact, I had a chance of talking to the IRL points leader, a fellow by the name of Sam Hornish.
Yeah.
He's 22.
Yeah.
And this kid's 4 years out of high school. His high school sweetheart is who he's dating now. Do you remember what it was that triggered your interest? Was it your first time there or seeing a race or listening to it on the radio? What fit you?
Well, I've always been interested in racing. Since I was a kid, I just the car nut, you know. Mm-hmm. I loved automobiles. I loved racing. And to go to the biggest race in the world, you know, was quite a thrill for me. And my first trip around the track was Sam Hanks driving me in a pace car. And that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was a convertible. I had my arm off the right side, you know, hanging on the door. And we go through one, and he's off about 4 or 5 feet. And I leave my arm there. And coming through three, got a little closer. Then coming back around four, and then he got into one, between one and two, and he got up a little bit closer to that wall. I pulled my arm down. And he said, I wondered how long it was going to take to get that arm off of there.
Was it back in, I want to say, mid to late 80s, you were looking into being part owner of a team?
Yeah, I was. Barry Green and I got together, and I wish I'd have gone through it, but and we had a Holiday Inn as a sponsor, but I was giving away too much. Mm-hmm. I was giving away about $5 million worth of advertising for nothing, you know, not nothing, but to sponsor the team. And I just felt it was a little too much.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I'd have gone ahead with it.
Well, is it too late to
get... Knowing how good Barry Green is, you know, and he's proved that. He's been very successful. You know, I would like to have been a part of that, but it didn't happen.
There's been no other offers or interest to rekindle something?
No, not. You know, I've had a couple of people say, why don't you get back in? I said, no. I've been too busy. I'm a hands-on kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've been so busy working the last, 30 years.
Yeah.
That it takes too much time. Away from the work or the racing, take your pick.
Mm-hmm.
And so one would interfere with the other, and I just didn't want to do that.
Do you have a favorite race for all the years you've watched and been here?
Oh, I think when Danny Sullivan mm-hmm. did his famous spin and won it.
The year you paced it last time.
Yeah, that was my favorite. You know he had the flat spot those tires.
Mike, one of the things, and I think you can hear it in that clip, one of the things that I've always heard about James Garner is kind of what you alluded to going into it, and that is that of those that came to the Speedway, and look, he was an A-lister of all A-listers at the time that he was around the Speedway, but I have always heard one of the most down-to-earth and just gracious guys that was just a fan and was happy to be there.
Absolutely. Super, super approachable guy. Absolutely approachable. And I thought that clip, though, was fascinating because when he's talking about having a possible deal where he was going to be a part owner with Barry Green and with Holiday Inn sponsorship, I mean, that would have been a really interesting IndyCar. Can you imagine the Green Holiday Inn ride, at the Indianapolis 500 with Barry Green and James Garner as a team? I mean, I think that would have been an interesting combination. So I'm glad we were able to play that clip. That was a great nugget I found. From the all-night race party.
Would have had to have been known as the Holiday Inn Express, I would think, if it was a fast enough car. But when it was out on the racetrack, perhaps it would have been the dulcet tones of Tom Carnegie that would have mentioned Holiday Inn and everything taking place with the car. Of course, the legendary public address voice of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that served in that capacity for 60 years. He made a stop at the all-night race party, and Tom Carnegie talked about how it all began.
I started in radio in 1942 in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at WOWO and WGL. We had two stations, and I loved working for them. They were owned by Westinghouse. And all of a sudden, I get a phone call from Gene Pulliam, who was the owner of the Indianapolis Star, and also the radio station WIRE, invited me down to talk over getting a job. And so I left a $35 a week job and took one in Indianapolis. Actually, the call was placed by Wally Nerling, who was an announcer at WIRE in that era. And he had talked to Mr. Pulliam, and Mr. Pulliam made the suggestion that I come down. And I was very happy to come here. And so within a few months, a fellow by the name of Tony Holman bought the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and I didn't know that he was a well-known sportsman and the family background, and I knew that Wilbur Shaw was out hunting for an old prospective owner, and that things were not going too well after World War II. And it really, the impact of the announcement didn't strike me as important as it turned out to be. And I think that was that day when they announced that Tony Holman had bought the track is probably the most important part of the history of the track in succeeding years.
Exactly. How did you get this gig?
Actually, how I wound up getting the job, Firestone Tire and Rubber Company asked me to do a commentary on an antique auto show that was part of the pre-race pre-race day activities. And so I did that. Tony Holman and Wilbershaw heard me on the public address system and became interested and wanted me to work race day. So that was 1946. And I was here on time. About half the audience was, you know, such a rush of people coming in that day that unexpected. Had a lot of them right after the war, people had nothing to do, no competition for the 500 like there is today. And thank golly, they arrived. They just kept coming. And I look back as a scared kid, wondering how I was going to find words to describe a sport that I'd never seen in action except once. And that was a dirt track race in Illinois. And I visited an uncle, and he took me out to the fairgrounds, State Fair, you know, and we saw a race. And that was my first experience of even seeing a championship race. I listened to it on the radio.
Okay.
Graham McNamee, I remember him announcing it. That's a long time ago, Mike.
You know, Donald Davidson has said, Mike, and I think it is a very good point, that when you think about the Indy 500 at its apex and the rise, the zenith of the race in the American culture, you know, obviously Tony Holman is a main player. AJ Foyt's a main player. Mario Andretti's a main player. Along with that, I think Tom Carnegie and the drama and the suspense that he could create using his voice and his cadence, especially through qualifying, is a key contributor towards the popularity of the Indy 500.
There's no question about it. I mean, the way Tom Carnegie could draw you in just with his voice, just, you know, you won't believe it. You know, it's another one. It's another new track record. You know, those type of things that he did. And it just, he drew you in, and it was just something that people wanted to hear Tom Carnegie on the PA as much as they wanted to see the cars. It was just, he was as big a star as the drivers at some level. So yeah, I agree with you. And I think Tom Carnegie at times doesn't get enough credit for, you know, how popular he helped make the Speedway.
And of course, I mentioned Donald Davidson, obviously a key contributor to the All Night Race Party, and Donald a key contributor to all things when it comes to radio, talking about the Indy 500 and sharing stories like he did in 2002 when he stopped by the race party and told a story about the legendary Jim Herdebees on the all-night race party from some 23 years ago.
WIBC 1070 WIBC, the all-night race party continues and rolls on all the way till 5 o'clock in the morning. A lot of things that are happening behind the scenes. And somebody that was starting to make a name for himself over the past year or so in the late 50s, early 60s, is a fellow by the name of Jimmy Herdebees. Later, James Garner calls him Jimmy Herdebees. Anyway, Donald Davidson tells us a little bit more about Jimmy.
Jim Herdebees was a rookie. And he was driving for Ernie Roos, the Trapalon Trailer Special. And he, during practice, I don't know that anybody was paying a great deal of attention to him until it got to be the last qualifying day. And in the morning practice session, several people started to get some very spectacular times on the stopwatches. Now, they weren't running they didn't time every lap electronically in those days. They did have a timer, but it could only do one car at a time. The track record was Eddie Sachs had won the pole at a four-lap average of 146.8 or 9, and there were a couple of 147-mile-an-hour laps in there, so that was the record. And several people started looking at each other and on their stopwatches and said, I just got Herdebees at 148. Well, you know, that can't be. He's a rookie. Anyway, when it came time for Herdebees to go out and qualify, I think the first lap was 149-something. He did three laps for 149, and one lap where he bobbled was 148. But the best lap was 149.601. So the 150-mile-an-hour lap, which looked like it was still a few years away, suddenly could be the next lap. what he had done was he would dirt track it. I mean, he was very, very brave. And a lot of people that just only knew Hurtubise in the later years, he would go sideways and just stand on it and power slide out of the turns. And so when he came in, of course, he was grinning from ear to ear and the place was going crazy and being congratulated on the PA. And he said, well, you think this is something? Wait till next year when my friend Parnelli Jones gets here, then you'll really see something.
Believe it or not, there is more. The party is still ongoing. That's why it's an all-night race party, even though it's an early evening edition of it. Taking a look back at the great clips, we'll continue to do so when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Hane has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Back home again. It's the month of May in Indianapolis. And this year, the action is not just at 16th and Georgetown, but also at the new Racing Club of Indianapolis, the greatest spectacle in dining and dancing.
Welcome, race fans. This is Ricky Eichel to Mike and Jonesy's. My wife, Jonesy, and I have opened the most unique restaurant and dance club in downtown Indianapolis. Not a franchise-themed restaurant with rock stars and Hollywood movie stars. No, just race car drivers. Enjoy fine dining, lunch, and dinner with the fast and famous heroes of Indy. See over 1,000 pieces of memorabilia of your favorite Indy cars, sprints, dragster, and stock car drivers. And watch all the racing on 25 TVs. Then dance all night with Indy's best sound, playing your favorite retro and current dance hits.
And he's on it. It's a new track record. The Racing Club of Indianapolis. The greatest spectacle in dining and dancing. Downtown. Next to Ike and Jonesy.
Say those four famous words again.
Mario's slowing down.
Mario might be slowing down, but I can assure you the Racing Club is not. They apparently don't serve decaf at the Racing Club. Jake Query along with Mike Thompson inside the Legal Hensley Group Race Command Center. You said it, Mike. That commercial was something. A lot to unpack there, right?
I just wish that I had been to that place. I wish it was still open, and I would definitely partake in that place. So.
I have a feeling they might watch WWE there. I'm not absolutely certain, but fairly positive. A little bit cringeworthy, maybe, that ad, which leads us perfectly to our next topic. And that was when Steven Tyler came to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, of course, to sing the national anthem and put his own twist on things. And Mike King, the longtime broadcast anchor for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network, shared his thoughts on the most infamous pre-race moment, one of them in IMS history.
Yeah, I mean, obviously everyone who's listened to the race knows that Steven Tyler did an interesting rendition of the Star Spangled Banner. I was just asking Mike off the air what went through his mind as he had to go back into the network after Steven Tyler does the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah. Being an Aerosmith fan, as you know, honestly, I remember ice skating to Walk This Way when I was come on, yeah,
but that one.
But you know, so being an Aerosmith fan up until the point that he changed Home of the Brave to the Home of the Indianapolis 500.
Mm-hmm.
It was just about what I expected. I mean, no, you know, I didn't really care for his scatting there in the middle. or whatever it was during that part.
Pretty
but
good.
But it was still pretty much what I expected.
Right.
I mean, it's Steven Tyler, the front man for Aerosmith. What else is he going to do? But when he changed it at the end, that's when I thought, man, he shouldn't have done that. And you don't know what to say. And all I said, because where we are in the pagoda, we were looking straight down on him. And, you know, interestingly enough, he had a teleprompter for that song. And so we're looking right down on him there on the victory platform. And so I'm kind of looking over and down. And as soon as he finished, my words were, that was interesting. And that was the way we came out of the national anthem. And I, just as I said, that was interesting, I turned around. And Johnny Rutherford, who's right beside of me for the broadcast, was standing there still basically at attention because JR stands, and we talked about this last year, JR stands at like military attention when for the national anthem. And I turned around, and I mean, his face was as red as a fire truck. And he was furious. And, yeah, I mean, it was literally one of those things where if it was a cartoon, he had smoke would have been coming out of his ears.
Yeah, with a train whistle sounding.
Yeah, and the second that I turned around and looked at him and I said, well, that was interesting, I knew that was as far as that was going. We weren't talking any more about the national anthem, and we didn't. That was the only thing we said.
An interesting version of the national anthem from Steven Tyler of Aerosmith fame, and one that I think many of us will remember for quite a while.
And you can't take a look back at great moments in radio history without talking about one of the greatest finishes of all time. Bob Jenkins, Paul Page, talking about the 82 Indy 500.
Oh, my fondest, absolutely, was Gordon Johncock and Rick Mears, because it was so totally predictable. Well, the finish wasn't, but the fact that they were going to be side by side on the final lap was. And I remember doing the calculation in the booth and thinking, he's gaining so many tenths per, you know, just because Bob and I have always just been like midget and sprint car guys anyway. And so you're always doing intervals and everything. And wow, the math works out. These two are going to be together on the white flag.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hit a commercial and I told the guys that. I said, the way I'm figuring it, and everybody, oh, yeah, yeah. And so it just went that way. And it was incredible. You could hear, I knew where the cars were in the old master control tower by the crowd.
Oh, really?
You could literally hear the crowd rotating around that track. It was amazing.
In 1982, the thing I remember about that, quite honestly, was just being a part of the last couple of laps of that race, because I have always felt that those last two laps, even though it was a closer race in 92, I really felt that those last two laps were as good a live radio broadcasting as you can possibly have anywhere. Everybody just clicked together. They worked together. The whole thing was so smooth. And it was a big thrill for me to get to throw to Paul. And, of course, I used the words, Paul Page, who's going to win it? You know, and
like, I haven't a clue.
It's a battle to the finish as we're watching. Into turn three.
Mears is right on the rear wing of Gordy Johncock as
Mike, one of the things I've always found remarkable about that 82 radio call, Bob Jenkins' voice does not crack at all when he throws it to the main line to find out who wins it. I always thought that was a very underrated aspect of that call.
The voice of the 500, Paul Page, who's going to win it? You know, that's just really just draws you in, an outstanding call.
One of the great calls for certain. A lot of great memories. We thank you for listening to the Friday Night Race Party here on Beyond the Bricks.
El sarampión es una enfermedad seria y altamente contagiosa. De acuerdo a los CDC, uno de cada cinco enfermos de sarampión en los Estados Unidos serán hospitalizados y corren el riesgo de desarrollar discapacidades de por vida. Este año se ha detectado un caso de sarampión en una escuela preparatoria al sur de la Florida. Para mejor protección, tus hijos necesitan dos dosis de la vacuna MMR administrable desde los 12 meses a 6 años de edad. Vacunación gratuita está disponible mediante el Departamento de Salud del Condado de Orange. Protege a tus hijos contra el sarampión. Visita protectyourchildnow.net.